Professor Stanley Kowalski on the role of IP and government in the production of the COVID-19 vaccine. This is The Legal Impact, presented by the University of New Hampshire Franklin Pierce School of Law, now accepting applications for JD graduate programs and online professional certificates. Learn more and apply at law.unh.edu. Opinions discussed are solely the opinion of the faculty or hosts and do not constitute legal advice or necessarily represent the official views of the University of New Hampshire. So, Stan, this is in response to a New York Times opinion piece titled, "Want Vaccines Fast? Suspend Intellectual Property Rights." They'll be sure to link in the episode description if you want to check it out. I'm going to cut right to the chase that you fundamentally disagree with the sentiment of this piece, but it's a common opinion on healthcare research, development, and production. Before we dive deeper, what are the two sides to this argument from a very high level?
There's multiple sides, but let's take the two largest arguments that they have. One is that since initial research in the development of vaccine and vaccine platform technologies is largely funded by government funding agencies, for example, the National Institutes of Health in the United States and similar government entities in Britain and Germany, since that's the case, vaccines and medicines should be freely available and not covered and not protected by patent rights. That's argument one. And the second argument is that the patents themselves are monopoly rights, which inhibit access to developing countries. For example, in this article, the authors cite 100 developing countries have petitioned the WHO, WTO to provide access to the vaccines without the attendant patent, and I say in quotes, monopoly rights. So there's two different arguments which advocate that, as the authors point out, suspend the intellectual property rights, in other words, suspend the patent rights, and that will, in a way, promote access to these vaccines across the globe. This raises the question then, will that really be the case? In other words, the question is, would we have these vaccines if there had been no patent system in the first instance?
Essentially, the markets have shown otherwise, that we've had so many vaccines developed over the last, generations at this point, that kind of prove opposite to their point, correct?
Well, yeah. Let's talk about the patent system in a broader perspective now. The authors of this publication are focusing on one aspect of the patent system, and that is the concept that the patent system is a wall. In other words, a wall which blocks us access to the vaccines. The intellectual property rights are conceptualized as a brick or mortar fortress which inhibits or prohibits the access to these particular vaccines. Now, let's look at it in a broader perspective. What is the patent system? The patent system is actually what? The patent system is can be viewed as a contract. A contract in what sense? It's a contract between the inventor and the government. The deal is this: the inventor is granted a limited property right, not a monopoly, as the authors say multiple times, but it's a limited property right to exclude others from making, using, selling that particular invention. The other side of the bargain then is the inventor is obligated to disclose all aspects of that particular invention in the patent document. What does that do then in the context of vaccines? Well, what that does is that provides an enormous amount of information and knowledge, which becomes a vast public good. The vast public good then is what we call off-the-shelf technology. Now, there are many, many, many patents on various vaccine technologies, tens to hundreds of thousands of patents. All that information is publicly available in patent databases. That information then is off-the-shelf technologies, which are critical in rapidly developing subsequent vaccines, because vaccines are assemblies of methods and components. Therefore, in the context of the coronavirus, COVID-19 vaccine technologies, they were developed largely with off-the-shelf, previously patented components, which would not have been there but for the patent system which I just described.
What role would the World Trade Organization take in this on either side of this argument? That was a cornerstone of this piece, and I was kind of confused how they necessarily have any part except for distribution.
Well, there's the World Trade Organization and the World Health Organization. It's important to distinguish between the two of them. The World Trade Organization is the administrator of multilateral treaty called TRIPS, which is trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights. Now, pursuant to that particular treaty, which nearly every country in the world is a member thereof, is there are provisions for forcing licenses on vaccine manufacturers. It's called a compulsory license. However, this can create problems because a compulsory license can force the owner of the patent to license that particular vaccine technology in a given country. However, there is a tremendous amount of information which is needed to scale up a vaccine to large-scale production, that is, trade secrets, know-how, and show-how. That's a big problem with a compulsory licensing scheme with the World Trade Organization. The other problem is quality control. Now, when I say that, let's talk about the main vaccines which are coming to market. We have one by AstraZeneca, one by Pfizer, and one by Moderna. The patent system is important not only for their business models and to promote investment in research and development, because early stage vaccine technology, our research and development of the technology is risky and expensive, but it's also quality control, because as the owners of the patents, they can thereby control who manufactures and how they manufacture and quality control, which in the context of vaccines is critically important. And the other aspect I want to point out to this too is the importance of the information. The information in the patent databases, which is quite vast, these companies have sought patents, and they will be publishing patents, and this information will be subsequently available. The patent system is a wealth of information, and I just want to point out to make a plug for our school, Professor John Kavicki and a student named Keith Kevelson have gone to the trouble and done a lot of work to assemble, on our website, a coronavirus intellectual property resource, which is a compilation of publications which deal with the production and the intellectual property rights associated with these coronavirus vaccines. So this type of aspect to the patent system is often and frequently neglected. You don't see it mentioned in this article at all, the disclosure side of the patent system, which was critical in the rapid assembly of these development of these particular vaccine technologies.
It seems like the way you're outlining as the positive of the current patent system is going to be especially important with regards to COVID-19, which is going to, it already has, is going to mutate over time, and it's going to be different. It might very well come back next year with new strains, which would entail a new vaccine. Very similar to the flu vaccine, which every year there's different strains of the flu that require every year the pharmaceutical companies to work off of their existing patents to create the next best flu vaccine for the strains that are currently in the ecosystem.
Right. And there's actually the BBC recently ran a story where precisely they have evidence that that is occurring. So then that makes it all the more important that the companies that produce vaccines retain their intellectual property rights. And it makes it all the more important that the government funding is there at early stages in order to develop vaccines. To to give this all away would, in a way, as the authors appear to advocate, would be a disincentive for that kind of public investment and private investment. Because looking at what's happening with every one of the vaccines, it's a public-private partnership between the government, the industry, and frequently a university entity who work together in partnership. And that system is critical in developing these vaccines. It's somewhat ironic that the vaccines are developed with taxpayer money in Britain, Germany, and the United States, with corporations who are based in these countries, and yet the developing countries who have not invested in this want access. So I think there's somewhat disparity, and I want to emphasize these discussions have been going on similarly since the AIDS HIV crisis of 35 years ago. Same arguments have been going on decade after decade. And it raises the question as to at what point will at least some of the developing countries begin to build their own pharmaceutical industries that will be at the level of Pfizer, AstraZeneca, Moderna, and Glaxo, to become part of the global industrial pharmaceutical industries and partners in development, as opposed to seeking compulsory licenses and suspending intellectual property rights. So that's another side of this argument too.
And going off of what you're saying about the public-private partnership, the argument in this article basically is, or a portion of it, he outright says that because pharmaceutical companies receive taxpayer funding for the creation and distribution of this drug, it belongs to the people. That isn't how it works in almost any other industry. I mean, farmers receive tax subsidies. It doesn't entitle us to whatever the farmers produce for free, whether or not it's for the betterment of society. It's there's economics in play. There's future production and research in play and things like that.
Right. And we and frankly, I don't know from the article when they say that the government had funded R&D into the vaccine production, how that funding was actually allocated. So it may have been allocated to public-private partnerships with universities and industry in order to accelerate development of vaccines. And once again, a lot of the investment is a public good, which comes from outstanding investment in research and development in vaccine technologies, which goes back 40 to 50 years, and is all that information is part of. All that information is actually a repository of a public good of information, which is freely available for subsequent development of new innovations in vaccines and medical technology.
And I mean, Pfizer on its own part received no funding up front. There was some confusion over that initially. The president of Pfizer actually came out and said, we've not received any Operation Warp Speed funding. We were looking for funding after the fact, after we've proven we've got a drug we can distribute, so that way they can work entirely independently of the government.
Right. And also, we have to distinguish, like I said before, funding which is to the partners which work with industry, for example, university and national laboratories, which receive funding and then work with the industry to scale up towards commercialization. Because if, say, for example, a university like Stanford is working on a platform technology for vaccines, for the RNA technology, which is in all of these vaccines, apparently, that technology is basic R&D, which is funded by the government. Industry usually doesn't go there because it's too expensive and too risky. So it becomes what I wanted to call a public good. It's a public good because it's funded by the public. It doesn't mean that we as a public have immediate access and own every single downstream innovative product which comes out of a particular stream of money. It creates a public good which we benefit from when it's developed into a product. And then industry carries the risk of production and manufacturing distribution. There's risk at various levels in the stream. And the patent system helps industry to manage that risk by having control over the intellectual property rights, but also control over quality control, as I stated before. So this is a process, and for the authors to say, well, suspend intellectual property rights, then Pfizer will say, okay, then we don't want to be in this business. We'll make medicines for high blood pressure and other diseases, say multiple sclerosis or something like that, instead of working on these vaccines because it's too risky. So this is another disincentive. And so the authors are focusing on the so-called monopoly rights argument that this is a public good, therefore it should be accessed freely accessible to the public. But okay, then who's going to manufacture it? And are we going to be confident that if we get injected with this, it's going to be okay if it's being made by everybody and anybody? That's another problem too. I imagine some of the people would rather line up and get the Pfizer vaccine. In terms of compulsory licensing, I think it's important to mention that because the authors bring that up in this with the AIDS crisis of the 1990s and patent rights and compulsory licensing. What happened with that was that in Brazil, the Brazilians tried to force a compulsory license for HIV medicines, HIV medications, and they succeeded. They got the license. However, the Brazilians then found out that they didn't have the capability to scale up production, and it took them years to scale up production. Now, why is that? It is because the compulsory license is only on the published patent specification and materials and not on the know-how, show-how, and trade secrets. The authors mention that in the in this particular article about know-how, show-how, trade secrets, that that should also be available. But how do you make that available? What do you say to Pfizer? Hey, we're going to come into the labs and we're going to get all your information and you're just going to hand it over. And Pfizer will say, I don't think so. So what happened in Brazil? Without that, all that information available, in addition to the patents, the Brazilians were unable to scale up and produce the HIV medications, took years to do that. And in the time, that intervening time, many, many people passed away from AIDS. So then this begs the question of, wouldn't it be better for these particular countries to engage in partnerships with pharmaceutical companies and build their own capabilities in research and development in order to get up to speed and become part of the global R&D system in medical innovation? Because frankly, this has long been going on, as I just said, since the late 80s. It's almost 35 years now that these types of arguments have been going on. And it's like, okay, great, but why don't we move to the next step, which is many of these countries building their own innovative capabilities. But that's another podcast for another day.
Thanks for listening to The Legal Impact, presented by UNH Franklin Pierce School of Law. To help spread word about the show, please be sure to subscribe and comment on your favorite podcasting platform, including Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify.